Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. From the plots of Hollywood movies to the roots of Christianity, many see value in adversity and suffering. Yet, the great majority of us do our very best to avoid suffering in our own lives. So should we conclude that the value of adversity and suffering is an illusion? Or is it a vital and critical element in building personality and enabling a meaningful, fulfilling, and significant life? Joining us to debate the value of suffering are Britain's most beloved psychotherapist and author of Fat is a Feminist Issue, Susie Orbach, renowned transhumanist Anders Sandberg, and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Bristol, Javi Carrel. I'll now hand you over to our host for this debate, philosopher Julian Baggini.
Hello and welcome to this session at the How the Light Gets In Festival 2021, online edition, obviously. Our subject for this session is If It Doesn't Kill You, that famous aphorism of Nietzsche's. But if it doesn't kill you, does it really make you stronger? Well, from the plots of Hollywood movies to the roots of Christianity, many do see a value in adversity and suffering, be it in character building, boot camps, or overcoming the trials of difficult childhoods or adult life. Yet, the great majority of us, of course, do our very best to avoid suffering in our own lives. So, should we conclude that the value of adversity and suffering is an illusion? Is it perhaps a hangover from Christianity that modernity needs to exercise? Was it a vital and critical element in building personality and enabling a meaningful, fulfilling and significant life? Or have we even got a better answer to any of those from our esteemed panel? We have Javi Carrel. She is Professor of Philosophy, who knows a bit about suffering, having been diagnosed at the age of 35 with a very rare respiratory disease, which at the time she was told was likely to kill her within a decade. And this experience for her very much turned her philosophy into a discipline of immediate practical concern. And one fruit of that was her much acclaimed book, Illness. Susie Orbach is one of the UK's most influential and, should we say, beloved psychotherapists. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and her latest books are In Therapy and Bodies. Anders Sandberg is a researcher, science debater, futurist and transhumanist. His research centres on the ethical and social implications of social technologies and human enhancement. So the way we're going to begin is we're going to invite each of our speakers just to spend 3 minutes setting out their initial thoughts on this theme and really answering that question of whether or not this is all a load of romantic nonsense. Should we conclude the value of adversity and suffering is actually an illusion? Can we start with you, Javi?
Thanks, Julian, and hi, everyone. I guess my answer is very much rooted in the pragmatic, but not just pragmatic, also philosophical sense that adversity is not something we get to choose to contend with or not. So adversity is very much part and parcel of human life. And that is something that philosophers need to take very seriously. Because when we think about the good life, we can't just say, well, the good life is where everybody is healthy, happy, in love, and content in every respect. I mean, we can say that, but that would be a very naive and very limited picture that would be very disconnected from the lives we actually lead. So a much better starting point is something that we could call roughly the facts of life, namely that we are always vulnerable to suffering, vulnerable to affliction, that we are dependent on others for the prevention or in the amelioration of suffering, and that we are afflicted in many ways over the course of our life. It could be physically, it could be mentally, it could be in a political context. The sources of suffering are many. The possibility of overcoming them completely is not even remotely within our horizon, quite the contrary in many respects. So I think we are much better off trying to grapple with the notion of the good life and ask ourselves, what would a good life be like with adversity and with suffering within it? How can we cultivate a reflective coping towards experiences of suffering that don't destroy us, but perhaps edify us in some respect? So what is really important is to not deny or try and eliminate the possibility of adversity, because fundamentally, I think that the key word here is vulnerability. It's not that necessarily affliction will strike, but that we are fundamentally and profoundly vulnerable to affliction at any given moment. And many of us, I think, work very hard to try and cultivate the illusion that we are not. And that illusion, I think, comes at a considerable cost. So what we ought to do is think about, prepare ourselves, if we like, perform philosophical exercises of various types to try and prepare ourselves for what that affliction will do to us when it happens, when old age comes, when infirmity comes, when we lose a loved one in some way. And the reason I'm saying this so emphatically is because I've spent a lot of time thinking about the case of illness, which I think is a really paradigmatic example of precisely that type of reflective coping, or at least the invitation we might have to reflectively cope with illness in ways that don't destroy us, that don't let us surrender to this picture of illness as this monolithic and interminable suffering, but a much more creative and compassionate towards ourselves approach, I think.
Okay, thanks very much. A bit of adversity to deal with in terms of, I think, some children trotting around the background somewhere trying to disturb us. But that's the kind of adversity which we can happily deal with as part and parcel of the rich tapestry of life. Susie, could you like to share your initial thoughts?
I'm very close to what Harvey's saying, because a problem for me is the terms of this debate pose adversity and suffering as optional or unnecessary constructs. And kind of assumes a measuring stick, and that we've labeled the weights incorrectly so that we're in an avoidable cultural and personal fog, which I think is the wrong way to look at it. That seems to me to do away with cultural practices, not just religion, but the arts and scientific endeavors in which the search for self-expression and collective expression occur. And we make art and science because we are striving an expressive species. We make change, we transform what is, we build new practices and thoughts out of earlier created and lived structures. And as adolescents and adults, we make relationships motivated by hope. Now, we wouldn't have a word like hope if we didn't have a word like disappointment or despair or missing or things gone wrong. And we search for recognition, for enlightenment, for connection. If we fail to find what we seek, it can hurt. We can be despairing, we can be angry, or we can try again. And we often find ourselves destined to repeat in emotional terms what we've already experienced, so that good experiences breed good experiences, while difficult experiences incline one to difficult experiences. But with Harvey, I would say that we're all vulnerable. And I don't think of vulnerability only about adversity. I think that we've got the wrong notion of what constitutes happiness, that happiness is, for our culture, a very synthetic, like MSG, as opposed to proper chicken broth. It's like a sprinkle of something where somebody says, have a great day. And I want to say, no, I just want to have the day I'm having, frankly, because happiness itself comes out of the denial of the complexity of our emotional experiences. And at this particular moment, I think, is tipping us into thinking there is something about being victims that we need to take on board, which I'll leave it there because that's probably my 3 minutes.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm sure we'd come back to some of that later. Anders, I mean, Anders is a transhumanist. And of course, I think that most of us would, well, if we know anything about transhumanists, would say they tend to be of the view that, you know, that you tend to take a view that people are too willing to accept the human condition as it is, and we should just, we can do better, right? So I don't know, I don't want to preempt your answer too much, but do you, if the question is, you know, the adversity and suffering has a value, are we at the very least overstating its value, because that's the best way to deal with the fact that at the moment we can't change it.
So I think suffering doesn't have value, but overcoming adversity is actually quite important, both individually and collectively. And when I got invited to be on this panel, that happened at an interesting point in time, because I was stuck because of COVID in Stockholm, caring for my frail elderly mother who was really suffering. She was in a great deal of pain. She was sick. And there is, of course, something very different when you're actually and having a family member experience something versus writing a philosophy paper about it. The interesting thing is things went well. She had some major surgery. She lost one of her feet, but she was much better afterwards. And we actually had a nice conversation over a bit of wine about that experience in the light of this invitation. And we both generally agreed that she was a much nicer person now than just a few weeks before. But also, we both agreed that was probably not because she had learned something profound from the experience. No, she was nasty because she was in pain and suffering and feeling really bad. Now she was no longer in pain and she was actually managing to get stuff done. On the other hand, I would argue she's a wise woman. But that didn't come from that particular illness. That came from a lot of other adversities and experiences throughout her life, some of which were very painful, others which were very neutral. So I think what is actually going on is that we actually need actual tough challenges but with stakes that matter to us. But the pain and suffering, they are kind of a cheap way of making something matter. If I'm suffering, I need to deal with it. I can't avoid it. That's an easy way, just like MSG in some sense, to make something have an intensity. But there are other ways of making things matter. If I'm in love, somebody else matters to me too, regardless of any potential for vulnerability or suffering. They matter because of who they are. So I think the important part here is we want to learn how to overcome adversity. And that probably requires training. It might be both fictional training, like playing games. It might be reading fiction, or it might be the small games you play on the schoolyard or in student politics, over to the actual games of real politics and dealing with actual anguish in life. But suffering is not really the important thing. That's the bad thing we're trying to avoid. And the goal, of course, of all this overcoming is becoming better at handling temporary suffering to get to greater rewards or be able to handle life in a better way. But I do think that even if we manage to one day turn ourselves into a suffering-free, secure posthumous that wouldn't have to suffer from illness, we would still find a lot of stuff that are suboptimal, frustrate our goals and complicate our lives. So we certainly get challenges. I think the fact that we're today living in a relatively secure world means that, well, we're not struggling every day to survive day to day. That has actually helped us develop some of our virtues. We might be going soft in some important directions, but sometimes it's good to have had a soft background. It's just that we also want to have that resilience for when something goes badly wrong. And that is, of course, I think, the thing COVID demonstrates is occasionally you get this global big disaster and then you actually need to find a way around it. But this is just like handling fire. You don't want to have fires too often. You want to have fire extinguishers and the fire safe home. But you want to be ready in the case of a fire. And in that case, you want to train a bit for it. But you probably shouldn't be training by being in a house on fire.
Okay, thanks very much for that. So I think, you know, adversity, yes, challenges, yes, suffering itself, not a value. I think I want to pick away a little bit this issue of suffering being an essential part of life, because I think Javi and Susie, certainly, I think Andrew's a degree, at the way we are at the moment, it's an unavoidable part of life. So in that sense, it's an essential part of life. But there is this question of whether or not it would be better if it wasn't, right? And also, I guess here then, you have to also think about what kinds of suffering. And I think this is interesting because I don't know whether it's a reflection of our times that in recent years there's been quite a lot of resurgence of interest in Stoicism. And I think a lot of the attraction of Stoicism is that the promise is it actually removes what Javi was talking about, vulnerability. It makes us maybe not invulnerable, but it's supposed to make us more invulnerable, less vulnerable to the things which are external to ourselves, to become more reliant on our own selves. And I don't know whether that is a manifestation of something in our culture which makes us less comfortable with vulnerability. I was going to go and have you first on this, but Susie's gesticulating wildly here.
See, I think there is a really interesting relationship between thinking about stoicism in modern times and vulnerability and suffering, because I think they're related to each other. I don't think you deny your vulnerability and you're stoical because you suppressed it. I think you accept your vulnerability, and that allows you to have it both in a private but also an intimate sense, if it makes sense, with a friend or a lover or a partner or whoever. So I don't think this should be posed as one or the other. I think they are very, very related. Now, maybe this is because I'm a therapist and can't contain their feelings, and they can't contain their suffering, whether it's rage or sorrow or whatever it is. The point of therapy is, in some sense, for that feeling to be transformed and live inside of them as the hurt or whatever the fundamental feelings are, and for them to then contain it. So I think they're two sides of the same coin, really, rather than oppositional.
So I mean, happy to turn to you on this. I mean, when you see it as being, you know, unavoidable, it's not something we choose, we can all agree with that. But is that something that we kind of, is just unfortunate and we have to deal with it always? Or do you think it's kind of good that there's some suffering in the world, you know? And I suppose that's the thing I'm not quite clear about when people talk about suffering being beneficial, whether they think we have to make them, it's there, we have to deal with it, we have to make the most of it, we have to sort of grow through it. But would it actually be better if we just didn't have it at all? I mean, would your life have been better if you didn't have this real problem to overcome with your own health, for example?
I think the question could be, can we, you know, if we were to think of adversity as a form of post-traumatic growth or edification, one obvious question is, well, aren't there easier ways to be edified or to grow without having to have the trauma first? It's an interesting one. And I think I would say that in terms of life as we know it, a life without adversity would be so far removed from anything recognizable to us that it would just operate under such radically different conditions that it's just quite hard to imagine what it might be like, to the point where you might think, is it even useful beyond being a sort of fantasy, I suppose, to think about that. And I think, you know, I'll call in Freud, if I may, on two points. The first is, you know, he famously said, I'm not a pessimist, I'm just a realistic person. I kind of see what reality is like, what people are doing to each other, you know, writing back in the early 1930s, for example. And I can just offer this idea that we have to help each other through these kinds of situations, but we mustn't delude ourselves into thinking reality is any prettier than it is. Okay, so that's one thing. The second thing, which I think is profoundly important, that he said, well, you can't get the good things if you're not risking the bad things. So if you want to love someone, that love entails with it the possibility of loss. If you're invested in an ideal or a goal, the risk of it not coming good or falling apart or disappointing you is always there. So it's really just the kind of the most fundamental emotional calculus. If you want to love, if you want to get attached, if you want to gain, you have to make yourself vulnerable in that way. And you're obviously making yourself vulnerable to the possibility of suffering and disappointment and pain. And so in a way, it's a package. And I don't think it's really very, I don't know how productive it is to ask ourselves, what would a human life look like without that whole aspect, because it's not clear to me that it would resemble in any way how we live and who we are now.
Well, but that's interesting. I will turn to Anders in a minute, because I think there are kind of different kinds of suffering, right? And now there are certain kinds, I think you alluded to towards the second part of what you were talking about, like, you know, relationships, projects, things where the possibility of failure is built in. And if you don't make yourself vulnerable to those failures, you also don't give yourself the opportunity of the benefits. And that's true. There are other things like, you know, disease and illness where that's not the case. If we could snap our fingers and get rid of, you know, relationships and projects because they have the risk of suffering, no one would do that because we want the rewards. If I could snap my fingers and there's no more cancer, there's no more of your lung disease, there's no, most of us would say we would do that. So it seems like although there are some sufferings are tied in with good things, and it's a package, in other ways it isn't. And I'm wondering whether, with that light, if we turn to someone like Anders, who's a transhumanist, they're not perhaps quite the, maybe not quite the completely sunny utopians that we might think, that you want to get rid of some kinds of suffering, right? But you, even you think you can't get rid of all suffering for the reasons that Javi have explained. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so my friend David Pierce, he wrote a big manifesto in the late 90s, The Hedonistic Imperative, where he laid out his project about getting rid of suffering and only maximizing pleasure. And of course, the obvious argument is, wait a minute, how do you even function in such a world? And he is arguing that there are information-sensitive gradients of bliss that would be directing the post-humans in this world. Now, how that would actually work is an interesting technical, biological, philosophical problem, which I don't think anybody, at least not Dave, thinks has actually been solved. But I think there is something interesting that there are some forms of suffering that are instrumental. If I hurt myself, pain signals and should not just tell me that I need to be careful about with the wounded part of my body, but also that I should definitely stop doing whatever is hurting it. And that links necessarily over to an emotional system. There is an emotional component to pain, which is where it ties up with actual suffering rather than just telling me that, oh, I stubbed my toe. Now, we might want to modulate that emotional part, especially when it's not relevant. But there is other forms of suffering like social pain. If I'm feeling lonely, so part of my brain gets activated that actually overlap with the emotional part of the pain system, even though there is actually not at all any physical component. Now, the really interesting thing is also, if I get disappointed, something was not as good as I had expected it to be, then I also get this kind of activate. So that is a kind of common pathway. Now, we want to be information sensitive. If bad things happen, I don't care. Then I'm kind of failing at life. I want to fine tune this so I don't get that unnecessary suffering. And the really tricky part of suffering is that it's something that becomes part of us. I am suffering. One of the best ways of avoiding the pain and suffering is, of course, to say there is suffering and say that there is no self. It's not tied to me in particular. That's a quite useful trick sometimes when you're at the dentist or something. But quite a lot of important things need to be tied to our identity. We can, of course, argue that actually maybe having that cohesive self isn't that, haven't the Buddhists been telling us that we should give up on that? And maybe there are actually be other ways of organizing how one functions that are utterly different. And again, very interesting options here. But I do think that, a suffering-free world would have to run in such a different way that we would say those inhabitants are not quite human, but actually quite different. Mm-hmm. And we, on the other hand, get in a world that has much less suffering. And I think, and we can still probably be recognizably human. Because what I think we want to do is deal with the meaningful forms of adversity, the stuff that actually matters. Quite a lot of the pains and aches we're getting are just because of biology telling us a signal over and over again, even when we already got the message. And we want to figure out ways of focusing on what matters for us to fix.
I'm happy to come back to you on that, because I picked up and then we'll come to Susie. I did pick up on what you were saying without giving you the chance to immediately come back. So is there something you want to pick up on that?
So three quick things. I mean, the first on you said eradication of cancer. I think, again, if we want to conduct a thought experiment, we have to make the case that it is still relevant enough to how we live now. If we make it so fantastical, so as not to, resemble us in any deep sense, they've got a limited effect, again, beyond being a nice fantasy. And if you look at that what philosophers have said about the possibility of immortality. I think a lot of them concluded, most famously Bernard Williams, that it would be intolerable and very tedious to be immortal. And this, the fact that we are embodied and that our bodies are vulnerable to affliction and disease is such an integral part of who we are and such an important thing to contend with and to come to terms with that I think denying it is just, again, I don't think it's philosophically productive.
I think we might empirically want to test it, though. We might actually want to have a bunch of immortals checking whether Williams was right and so on. But yes, it's going to be relatively far in the future.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, when you start unpacking it, you say, well, what do you mean immortal? If what sort of organism would you even be so that you could never die under any circumstances? And, you know, you've got to be quite specific and flesh out what kind of immortality you're talking about. Is it the Jonathan Swift type where you become increasingly decrepit until your life isn't worth living? Or is it the kind of Williams type where you just get stuck at the age of 42 and you carry on as in the kind of Elena Macropoulos case? Or is it something else altogether? But it's got to resemble how we are now. We are, you know, fleshly and vulnerable in all the relevant respects.
Okay, we're going to come later perhaps to what possibilities there may be for things to change from that. But you did have two other points, Javi, so perhaps you could come to
the second. I was thinking of Val Plumwood, who was an eco-feminist who got attacked by a crocodile in the Northern Territories in Australia and wrote a very moving piece that said a lot of things. One of the things was it made her realize she was just part of the food chain and that it was okay for a crocodile to try and eat her, that we are not, you know, above nature in that respect. And the third, going back to the Stoics, again, this idea that we can rid ourselves of suffering, it's what we want to do is to practice philosophy in a way that helps us reduce suffering, diminish the amount of mental noise and anguish we experience. But that complete eradication is an ideal. It's not something we can, you know, hope to reach by doing a little bit of meditation. So again, I think a healthy dose of realism is helpful here.
Yeah. Susie, you've been waiting patiently.
I don't know if this helps us at all, but I suppose I think about cultural and political suffering. I mean, in other words, the structures that we live in as being very, very cruel. I don't really have a problem with us trying to reform them. In fact, I would love us to be able to reform them so that we don't live in such deep inequalities, okay? And I think those inequalities cause phenomenal individual and collective suffering. Wherever you end up, it's very different where you end up. But so I can see but the interpersonal suffering and the intrapsychic suffering, I think, is inevitable. And I don't know if we could divide it. I'm kind of even happy for the transhumanists to give a go at thinking about social structures. I still want to be material, though. I don't want to be decorporalized. I don't want to be dematerialized. I want to be a human being, as Harvey says, with a body, living from a body, which means that I'm sensate. But I wouldn't mind us being able to think about how we were able really to change the structures which caused so much damn suffering. And I know for me, as a youngster coming into second wave feminism or the civil rights movement, was really transformative in terms of changing personal suffering into collective understanding and then personal, I suppose, in today's language, which I hate, would be growth, right? But it didn't stop the certain internalizations of hurt, which are going to happen just because I'm a human being. So that's what I want to say.
It seems to me that our culture is just full of stories. We want to hear about how suffering promotes growth. And why wouldn't we? Because we're going to suffer and we want to know there's a good outcome. And I wonder, are we too unwilling to accept the fact that that's not always the case? And so, I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that we're too keen to kind of see the possibility of learning and growth in this as somehow?
I mean, I think we do want a story. I think we want a story, but we don't want just a rags to riches story. We want a story that goes to the side and surprises us. right? That's why we keep making stories, because if we just wanted we all lived happily ever after, it wouldn't have enough in it for us. I think we want something that's got texture and something unexpected. I think human beings want, we're a curious species. We have curiosity. We don't want the same thing.
But it seems people do want the same fundamental arc. They want adversity and redemption. They want that redemptive conclusion, don't they?
They want an interesting conclusion. They want some... I suppose this is where I would go back to Freud, is to transform human misery into ordinary unhappiness. Mm. I think that is a very, very profound thought, because from there, you can have some really interesting things happen. So I'm not sure, you know, I don't know if Jews are into redemption, you know, particularly secular Jews. I don't come from the tradition of redemption. I come from, you struggle.
Yeah. I think there are different narratives, right? I mean, the stories or narratives or the way in which we think about adversity, it's not just, you know, suffering and redemption. I mean, I think the thing to really militate against is this cultural tendency to bright side, as Barbara Ehrenreich calls it. Mm. This idea that, you know, she wrote this book called Smile or Die, where she talks about being diagnosed with breast cancer, not being allowed to say anything negative about how she was angry about falling ill because, you know, she's going to upset other people and she could just make the cancer worse and all sorts of stuff like that. And she was saying, I don't want to be thinking like that. I don't want to be in this cultural vice telling me what I can and can't say. So really, we ought to, I think, more than anything, militate against social scripts telling us how to go through adversity. And you're right that the story of edification or post-traumatic growth could potentially be one such response. But the important thing, I think, to remember is to say, okay, you're given this adversity. Until recently, we just said, well, your life's just destroyed, with respect to disability. And now we're saying, no, actually, again, flourishing and the good life are not in the sole possession of those with perfect bodily health. Now we're more open to that thought. And that's progress. You know, that's a good thing. That enables a lot of people with imperfect or diseased or disabled bodies to say, I've got a claim on this notion of the good life. I've got a right to strive. I've got, you know, I can be included in that too. And I think that's politically and personally extremely important.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very good point.
Something about hope. Actually, they're thinking that, oh, there is hope for me, even though I'm now currently in a very bad situation. That's where these stories are extremely valuable. The problem is, of course, most of the stories are pretty bad stories, like everything else. You basically have a hero's journey narrative, which is, again, not the only story, but half of Hollywood has kind of figured out that, okay, we all make movies according to that one because the past ones have been big successes. So it even limits the way you might actually grow out of it or handle it and turn it into mere normal unhappiness or all the other possibilities. I think there is a real risk about people narrow off a little bit too much how you're supposed to be handling adversity.
But do you think, though, that, you know, as a society, as a culture, people do criticize younger generations, you know, the so-called snowflake generation, etc. Do you think there's anything to this idea that, you know, we've gone a bit soft and we just don't accept adversity as a natural, normal part of life? We expect it's going to be rainbows and things like that. I mean, Susie, what do you think?
Well, I guess I think that adolescence is just a terrible time to live through. And so is early adulthood. I certainly wouldn't ever want to have to go back there again. And finding your people and finding your tribe and, you know, in my day was absolute hell, particularly if you were not kind of the straightest, you know, finding Bob Dylan, although it was just extraordinary, or the civil right, extraordinary, because I think it's really different because there is this whole production of the notion of I've got to go back to what I said in the beginning of the production of happiness and the production of ambition. I've got to be a this and I've got to be a that and I've got to be happy all the time. And I think that is, it's not that it's, we're too soft. I think it's just a misperception of what constitutes being human, which is it takes a long time to find your people. It takes a long time to learn enough about yourself to not do things that really hurt you continually. It takes a really long time. And it's very hard, I think, because if you live online, which kids do, you're looking for a community of interest, it's very hard to find one that doesn't then box you in, as opposed to continue to say, yeah, you're going to be alienated for a hell of a long time. So I think there's something about the conditions of late capital and consumerism that mean the production of self is very, very difficult to manage any kind of feeling of authenticity. And that's why I think that people end up in having descriptions of mental health problems, which I don't actually necessarily think are mental health problems. I think they're ennui.
Yeah, it's also called living, isn't it? It's interesting that, I mean, when you said about, you know, it takes a long time to find your tribe, I mean, and maybe it may take a long time to find that you don't have one, for example.
Correct.
I remember many years ago, I was at a school at a conference, and somebody gave this little speech in which he told all these sixth formers present to, you know, sort of close their eyes and think of their passion and then to hold on to their passion for the rest of their lives. And I felt just obliged to sort of say afterwards, by the way, it's okay if you don't know what that passion is or you don't have
absolutely
one.
Absolutely.
You know? But the expectations, and they say the expectations are around, you know, achievement and having a very strong self-directed goal, etc. I don't know if Javier Anders want to come in on this point at all.
Yeah, I think there is something about expectation management. And this is, of course, a real problem, because I think in some sense, we have set enormously high expectations for how the world could be and how our lives can go. And then a lot of people are feeling very disappointed, partially justly, but also because expectations just got set ridiculously high, whether that is how good sex and romance is or how the world works. As a transhumanist, I, of course, had this annoying problem that, oh, I'm a 48-year-old transhumanist. When I was in the 1990s, we were expecting life extension and nanotechnology to take off any year now. Still kind of waiting, and my hair is starting to turn gray here. So there is something interesting about managing expectations in a sane manner. And that's, of course, also part of what I think is important in overcoming adversity, learning how to both expect the worst and prepare a bit for that, but also have that hope that things can go well. And in practice, there is a lot of other stuff that usually happens. Now, I think the people who talk most loudly today and moan most loudly online quite often need to work on their expectation management. But I do think there is also something interesting that maybe we do need occasion to have a fire drill. I personally think the COVID pandemic might have been horrendous, but it's such a good dress rehearsal for something truly nasty. The things with the team of biosecurity and the people at my institute are thinking about as worst case scenarios are way, way worse. Mm-hmm. And if we can do this dress rehearsal on seeing what we should be doing in the case of a bad pandemic, good. It could be worse and we should try to learn from it. The real problem is, of course, trying to learn from it. Because I bet once we're all vaccinated and everything opens up, we're going to so much want to never hear a word about that darn virus ever again. Unfortunately, that's the point where we actually should take those things and put it into routines and to make sure that next time something equally bad happens, we can keep a, perhaps a suitably stiff upper lip and do something about it. But the human nature is, of course, to want to forget it. So remember that we forgot the 1918 pandemic. We have our job set up for us.
Yeah, it seemed to me that even last summer, most people had forgotten there was a pandemic going on as soon as lockdown goes down. Expectations, very, very important. Because, again, one of the recurring themes here is there are different types of suffering, some avoidable and some aren't. And perhaps one of the more avoidable ones is the ones that are actually the result of false expectations. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's this thing which comes from Buddhism about, you know, the second arrow of suffering, right? So the first arrow of suffering is whatever, you break your leg, you get your illness, whatever happens. But the the second arrow is thinking, oh my God, why did this happen? You know, this shouldn't have happened, et cetera, et cetera. That second layer of suffering is actually often creates more anguish than the first. Pain is pain. You can deal with it. But when you're thinking to yourself, oh, this is awful, this is terrible, how could this have happened? You know, that on an emotional level can be more difficult. And maybe that's the kind of suffering that someone like Susan.
And there is even a third arrow where you're also afraid of disappointment. My dad was very much into trying to make me lower my expectations because he was so afraid of disappointment. And the problem was, of course, that after a while I started becoming afraid of being disappointed. Then I rebelled in the other direction. So now I'm totally willing to be disappointed. If we only get half of the transhumanist vision, well, so good, great, great, great. But we do make a lot of arrows we shoot at ourselves.
Yeah. So you've already said quite a bit, Anders. So we know you're not not a complete lunatic, at least. You may be a bit of a lunatic, I don't know. But you're not a complete lunatic. You know that some suffering is going to be inevitable because of disappointment, relationships, etc. But as a transhumanist, how far do you think we can go in eliminating suffering? You know, could we go a lot further than perhaps people think? And actually, you know, I've teased you a bit here. Do you find it a bit frustrating that as a transhumanist, you're almost like patronized and told that you're just, you've got childish and unrealistic expectations about the future?
Well, I think half of it, I think, is appropriate, and half of it, yeah, that's annoying. But the point is, of course, yeah, optimists are the ones that typically tend to produce change. Pessimists are the ones that also point out the bad directions of change. So you need both kinds. And I think we actually have an overly pessimistic culture that is very afraid of trying and risking things. Generally, I think we can probably, in some sense, get completely rid of suffering. But the question is, what prices are we willing to pay? I think having to take painkillers and getting rid of normal pain, we find, okay, that's good. Some of them are unhealthy. Opiates, okay, we need to get rid of addictiveness. What if we could modify our minds so we're mostly feeling bliss and so on? At some point, you might say, wait a minute, now it's no longer human. And I'm probably going to continue towards the weirder and weirder and weirder cases I'm writing in a paper where you end up with something that's not individual, that's not even like you. At some point, you will say, yeah, we're not interested in going further than that. But I do think that the space of possibilities is much bigger than what humanity has experienced. And given that the peaks and lows of human experience, there might be equally or even greater ones out there. And that's worth exploring. We might want to be rather careful about it. And I don't think everybody should just rush off to what looks like the first big thing. But people are unlikely to do that. Most people definitely don't want to mess around with their neurons or genes too much. They're going to leave that to the weirdos. And then hopefully we can learn a bit from their experience.
Yeah, I suppose that's it, isn't it? We don't all have to go in the same direction. Maybe there could be experiments in living. Susie Javier, easy, you can come in first on this. I mean, are there certain forms of suffering which you think we quite rightly should just unequivocally be looking to pretty much eradicate, you know? And sure, some suffering is connected with good things as a package, but how far do you think, you know, human society and could go in severely reducing it? Do you think it's a realistic possibility?
I would say one thing. I will go the Epicurean route and say, look, so we don't have to be slaves to our desires and the ensuing disappointments that Anders was just talking about it. So Epicurus strongly advises us to scrutinize our desires and to ask which of them are necessary and what he calls natural, and which of them are artificial or unnecessary or unnatural. And what he means by that is ones that are really insatiable. He says what happens with when you cultivate or you are a slave to unnatural desires, what you try to do is be as wealthy as you can, but you can always be wealthier. Be as famous as you can or as popular as you can, but you can always be more. And he says these types of desires are characterized by the fact that you could never, ever achieve them or fulfill them completely. So you're much better off suppressing them or overcoming them and saying, okay, let me focus on the ones that are, you know, are conducive to the good life. And I think that's a really kind of universal, you know, therapeutic philosophy offering that has received not really enough attention, I think. People are disappointed because they are not thinking, they're not critical towards the desires they are allowing themselves to cultivate. And, you know, we see, sorry, go ahead, Susie. That's kind of my general.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But that requires serious structural change, because that is the basis of late capital, is to stoke desire that cannot be met. I mean, So the problem is one of how we do our social organization. I mean, that seems to me, of course, we can't do what Epicurus says, because we are continually blandished to whether it's consume more or respond more to everything that happens, every blip on our machine or whatever it is. I mean, so that's one thing. The other thing I want to sort of say, which is, I see cruelty every single day. I don't mean now the social cruelty, which we talked about before, but the cruelty between parents and children. I mean, parents enact cruelty. Every parent does it. They don't mean to do it, but parents also have a very hard time being supported in our culture. And so the kinds of the kinds of things they foist on their children are really difficult. And that makes for children who grow up to be people who are not okay in themselves. I think we know that. So that seems to me something that needs to be addressed in this kind of discussion. I don't know how to discuss it from a philosophical perspective, though.
That's a great note to end on, Susie. Thank you very much to Susie, Javi and Anders.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice, and visit our website, iii.tv, for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.